Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shorty, bringing you the best of my Times Radio show. You can listen Monday to Friday, 10 till 1. And the exciting news that's just been announced today is that from February the 18th, I'll be handing over the reins every Friday to Ruth Davidson, who's joining the Times Radio lineup. She'll be on Fridays from 1 o'clock from February the 18th. Ruth Davidson, former Scottish Conservative leader. She's been on the pod loads of times, and you'll be able to catch on Times Radio from next month. Coming up on today's episode then, a very simple question: who is Liz Truss? Supposedly the race to replace Boris Johnson is a straight fight between her and Rishi Sunak, but a YouGov poll we had done for the show found that half of people didn't know who she was. So coming up on today's episode, it's some of it in her own words. We're going to try to find out who is she, what's she all about, and what are her chances really of becoming Prime Minister. So that's coming up in just a moment. But first, of course, it is Tuesday, so it must be Figovich.
Meet the Cerberus of columnists, the Janus of journalism, and the ultimate political portmanteau of opinion.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Finkelvich, with Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich on Times Radio.
Which means, Finkelvich, it's a very good morning to Daniel Finkelstein. Morning, Danny.
Good morning.
And a very good morning to David Aronovich. Morning, David.
Hi there. I think an evening of Johann Strauss waltz music would make me turn back and go back to France.
Would it?
Yeah.
So yes, apparently this is the only mad idea that Priti Patel has turned down. Number 10 dreamt up the idea of using sonic cannon to deter people from coming to Britain. And we've now reached the limit of things that even Priti Patel thinks are too tough. What song or sounds would deter you, Danny?
Oh, I don't know. Actually, good point. No, I think I'd be attracted by the waltzes or whatever David suggested. I don't think that would turn me down. But it is interesting that there are some ideas that are simply too mad, and that because they haven't got any ideas that actually work, we now get all the ones that don't work as well, so at least they seem to be doing something, even when they've decided not to do it.
Yeah, and just as she works her way through her Atlas colouring in book of countries that we could send people to for processing and so on. Let's talk about... there's been lots of these attempts to try and reboot Boris Johnson's premiership. You know, look over here, the Operation Red Meat, as it was called. A crackdown on boats crossing the channel was one of the issues. Going after the BBC was another one. Is this going to work, do you think, David?
Who called it Operation Red Meat? That's the first thing that I want to know. I mean, was that us lot, essentially? And we kind of pushed it onto them. So I
did appear to be an attempt, because first of all, there was Operation Save Big Dog, which everyone in government seems to concede is total nonsense. Operation Red Meat seems less disputed.
But is that what they called it? Operation, you know, because you know what the phrase throwing red meat to the dogs means is that you throw them something that they really want, and while they're kind of snarling, etc., you get to do the thing that you need to do without the dogs noticing. Is that essentially what we're saying that this is? I mean, I do remember on a previous newspaper of the Times, I was writing all kinds of things that were disobliging in the view of quite a lot of our readers. And so my editor at the time, the section editor, said, you know, what you need to do is give them some red meat. And I thought, you mean throw them stuff really strongly expressed that they already agree with? So that I can slip the other stuff past them without so much trouble. Is that what it is, so essentially?
Matt, the thing I think the red meat thing is quite plausible. It's the operation bit that strikes me as unlikely. it suggests a degree of planning and forethought that they don't seem to have. If they were creating a political grid, I don't suppose they'd have had parties on them to start off with. So the bit of it seems a bit unlikely.
I mean, there clearly does seem to be an attempt this week to talk about, just get everyone have a rummage round and get as much stuff out the door as they can. So you've got Dominic Raab today on magistrates' courts, Sajid Javid's looking at doing some of the NHS, and then, you know, the slightly more populist stuff, getting Nadine out to slag off the BBC, you know, all of that sort of does. It's clearly there is, whether or not it was an operation, or maybe it's just other people thinking, well, if Boris Johnson is going to go, I need to set out my stall. Being anti-BBC will appeal to one wing. Being anti-migrants coming over the channel is another.
It's not populist for the voters, though, is it? That's the funny thing. I mean, a lot of it is not quite populist for the voters. It's, as I understand the red meat, it's not red meat for the voters. It's red meat for the Tory backbenchers. And this is it feels like the real problem. The idea is, I thought, to shore up support for the Prime Minister at a time when people, generally speaking, seem to think that he ought to go away. What you do is you give them stuff they really like. It's a little bit like the evangelical Christian supporting Donald Trump, despite the fact that he's about as anti-Christian as you can possibly imagine, because he gives them what he wants in terms of Supreme Court judges, and therefore the evangelicals get what they want. It's a bit like that. We'll support you despite the fact that we know that you are a flawed vessel for what we want. And the dangers in that is, well, the obvious dangers. Firstly, these things don't work. You know, they don't work and they don't fly. And that just puts you back another 6 months until it doesn't work again and people have noticed that it doesn't work. And also the second thing is, it's not necessarily actually popular with the voters. I don't really think having a big attack on the BBC is particularly where voters are right now.
There's something more than that.
No, go on, Danny.
Go ahead. So I think there's something more than that. I actually think that even with Conservative MPs, despite the fact that, you know, some of them might want a well thought through strategy that was further to the right than the government is, that they would find it offensive and fairly obvious as well. That, you know, I don't think it's unreasonable to reconsider in 6 years' time the licence fee and what we pay for it, and whether or not, given the other things that are available, we want to cover as many things as we do with a licence fee quite that size. I think it's perfectly reasonable to discuss that. But to start to tweet that out in the middle of this row because some people are uncomfortable with some aspects of the BBC's reporting, I think that even most Conservative MPs and activists would find that not a very acceptable way to proceed, even if they were quite happy with the outcome. So I don't think it would work even with them.
And Danny, you've been in the heart of Conservative Party operations when in times of woe, I suppose is one way we could put it.
Yeah.
Often at those times of crisis is when the gap between what the party likes and wants and what the public likes and wants becomes even clearer, doesn't it? Actually, at the precise moment that Boris Johnson clearly is in trouble with lots of members of the public, suddenly pursuing an agenda which actually is quite niche when it comes to public opinion, there's a real risk in that, isn't there?
Yeah, look, I don't think it would work for a second. I don't actually even think it will work with party members, but David's certainly correct in thinking it won't work with the public. And if you have ideas that are only half thought through, for example, you know, the culture secretary tweeting out at 7:54 in the morning, this was the last licensory review, and then not being able to say at all what it is that she plans to put in its place. I don't think anybody thinks that's good government. And my view of it is that, you know, what I always say to politicians I'm giving advice to is start with what you think is the right thing for the country. Most of the time, that will be the right thing politically. If it isn't the right thing politically, try to think to yourself, why is it not the right thing politically? And explain and try to see where the gap is and how you can fill it. And I just think not following that advice has only ever got people into trouble, and that's what's happening now.
Matt, do you want to know what I say when politicians ask me for advice as to what they should do?
Go on.
Nothing, because they never ask me. They never ask me. And this is an insight into Danny's world, which I find really kind of interesting. And I think it's not fair. I think politicians should come and ask me my advice on what they should do. And Danny, tell me, why do you think they come to you and not to me? And I don't think they come to you, Matt, do they?
I think it's fair to say that I don't think any politician has ever asked me for my advice on anything.
Is it not true, David, that Tony Blair was interested in your advice, for example, on tuition fees?
That's the you know very well, because I gave you a letter from him that he sent to me thanking me for my for speaking on the subject. That was the one and only occasion. And I got a letter out of it, and it's now in your excellent and amazing collection.
It is. David very generously gave me that letter for my collection of prime ministerial letters.
Well, thank you, Danny, for stamping out that fake news from David. It turns out he is in the pocket of Sir Tony.
I've not had a single call from Keir Starmer. He never calls. He never writes.
It's only a matter of time. It's only a matter of time. I'm sure your knighthood is just around the corner, David. Let's talk about fairness. That's populism in politics. What about fairness in politics? Because there is a sort of thread that runs through from Novak Djokovic to parties in Downing Street. The one rule, you know, it's a cliche. It's a cliche for a reason. One rule for one and one rule for them and one rule for the rest of us. That is a big, that's a real sort of tension in politics right now, David.
That one was for you, Danny.
No, I said David.
Did you? Okay, my hearing. I'm terribly, terribly sorry. Actually,
he's just sitting there thinking about Tony Blair.
Oh yeah, if only Tony Blair. Tony, come back. I love you. I put this one down for discussion because I know that it's something that Danny's looked at quite a lot in terms of behavioural psychology and the way in which people respond. In other words, the notion of fairness, what constitutes fairness and what constitutes unfairness. All the way, and it was kind of slightly odd when Nigel Farage, for instance, kind of had himself pictured as a supporter of Novak Djokovic. And you rather than, this isn't a populist position to take up, actually, because people see Novak Djokovic as trying to bilk the system in an unfair way, which he can get away with, which they can't. And that's also underlined the things about the thing about the parties, which is why the attempt to try and, as some people have, to move it onto whether or not these restrictions were right in the first place as a kind of way of discussing it, hasn't worked in any way, because what people understand is a concept of fairness. Now, the fairness concept is really interesting, and Danny's written about this before, the situation in which people will actually forego advantage to themselves if they see that the element that they're getting is actually unfairly small. In other words, they consider, and the first thing that you understand with small children, almost the first kind of almost quasi-moral thing that they understand is the notion of fairness. And I just thought this is really interesting, and people forget it at their peril, don't they, Danny?
Yes, they do. And it relates, by the way, to what people put in, well, what they take out. So people have a fairness norm that relates to fair division of a given amount. But they also relate that fairness to what they've put in. And the reason why this issue, so you remember we discussed often what I said, more than a year ago, which is none of these scandals will matter till one of them really does. And the reason this one really does is because it's triggered the fairness norm in a way that the others haven't. People feel they've put in a lot and that somebody else is taking out of the system what they've put in, and they don't, and that they regard as fundamentally unfair. And this is the reason why it's extremely difficult to get a thought. You're right. What's happened with Nigel Farage is that the fairness norm has clashed with the attention-seeking norm. The fairness norm is that we must get out what we put in. The attention-seeking norm is that when there's a big news story, Nigel Farage wishes to be in it. I think that it is a fundamental inconsistency, clearly. This issue, one of the reasons this issue will not go away is because of the number of people who feel aggrieved because they themselves did some things that the government didn't do. It doesn't matter that you could point out to them the fact that you didn't do it and that they did do it are unrelated to each other, right? It wouldn't affect the fact that you didn't have to do it, the fact that they were doing these other things. Naturally speaking, people regard that as a terrible argument because they expected their sacrifice to be reciprocated, and it's the basis of human cooperation. So that is the reason why this one has been the one that, as we long discussed, is the one that mattered when the others didn't.
It makes me think of something else, Danny, which is a kind of precept that parents need to remember, really, which is that people take you on what they see you doing, not what you say. And if what you say and what you do is different, particularly when you're suggesting a precept to them that they ought to follow, and I mean, children are very, very kind of keen on this as well, that's where you have real disillusion and real disaster, actually. And you learn after a long time that actually children don't follow you in what you say. They tend to follow you by, if you like, your actual practical example.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I think that used to be a principle of modernisation when David Cameron got elected, which was a leader of the party, which was show, don't tell, right? That people will judge whether the Conservative Party is being modernised by what you do in response to certain things, and actually even how you dress, how you talk, the things that they can see rather than just the things that you've said you're going to do.
And we've seen a bit of that with sort of Keir Starmer keeps saying I am patriotic, whereas actually it doesn't mean anything to anyone. He needs to do a series of things which makes people think that is the case.
Yeah, he needs to go out and fight a war himself.
Exactly.
That's what he needs
to do. I'm sure you can advise him on that.
That's right. Keir, go out and fight a war. Personally fight a war. Show us what you're made of.
The other thing that just amuses me about Nigel Farage is him getting so cross about an independent country deciding who can and can't come in, which I thought was entirely the purpose of Nigel Farage in all matters.
He didn't mean white people.
Right, fine. I'll adjust my...
unless they're Romanians. I suppose Serbia is quite close to Romania.
Yes, the tennis, you've forgotten the tennis exemption, right? If you're a world tennis champion, you're exempt from that.
Daniel Finkelstein and David Ivanovich there, and of course you can read them in the Times. Every week, just pick up a copy of the paper or subscribe online. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/timeswebbox. Up next, who is Liz Truss?
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now, it's time for this.
Now then, Boris Johnson shows no signs yet of wanting to give up the keys to number 10, but that hasn't stopped lots of talk about the contenders to replace him. And the suggestion is already a straight race between Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, and the Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss. But the big question is, who is Liz Truss? She's the longest continuously serving cabinet minister. But in a recent poll for this programme, YouGov found 45% of people didn't know who she was. So what we thought we'd do this morning is take a look at Liz Truss, her life and times, and her politics. In a moment, we'll hear from some of those who've worked with her and watched her rise almost without trace through the cabinet. But first, in some of her own words, this is Liz Truss's life.
Well, I say my political views sort of went on a pathway. So I started off with two parents who were active members of the nuclear disarmament movement. I then moved, you know, I thought that was wrong because I reacted against the political correctness at school. I was annoyed by the sort of the idea that everybody can have prizes culture that pervaded in my comprehensive school in Leeds. It was seen as, you know, we talked about girly swats, but you were seen as a swat if you tried to do any work. And I reacted against that. I joined the Liberal Democrats because I thought they were the acceptable face of being right-wing in North East Leeds. I mean, I literally didn't know any Tories. A lot of my teachers were card-carrying members of the Labour Party.
At university, she became president of the Oxford University Liberal Democrats, even speaking at a party conference in 1994 in favour of scrapping the royal family.
I agree with Paddy Ashdown when he said, everybody in Britain should have the chance to be a somebody. But only one family can provide the head of state.
Does she still think that? That's what Liz Truss told me in 2019.
No, I don't. I think I was wrong. I was a professional controversialist in my teens. I used to like having
still
arguments.
Still are a little bit.
No. Honestly, it's been massively toned down. I used to like having arguments and discussions and exploring ideas. And some of the ideas I explored, I now think were a bit out there and I don't agree with. I'm actually a huge fan of the monarchy and I think it's an important part of stability of this country. But I think it's important that, you know, I was 19 years old at the time. I think it's important we allow people to express themselves and their ideas, and it's one of my great beliefs. And why I joined the Liberal Democrats is I did think they believed in freedom as a party, and that is my core political, you know, lodestar. That I hated being told what to do. I wanted freedom to live my own life as I saw fit. I didn't want to be stereotyped as a woman. I didn't want to be stereotyped as coming from the north or anything else. I gradually realised that the Conservative Party is actually the home for people like that, that believe those things.
After university, Liz Truss worked for Shell and Cable and Wireless and ran the Reform think tank.
And then I became a Conservative and absolutely loved it. Yeah. I found people that I agreed with, that I could relate to.
She stood for election for the Conservatives in 2001 and 2005, but it wasn't until she made it onto David Cameron's A-list of candidates that she secured the safe seat of Southwest Norfolk, becoming MP there in 2010. 2 years later, she was a minister and then joined the cabinet in 2014, making her the longest continuously serving member of the current cabinet, having served under David Cameron, Theresa May and Boris Johnson, first as Environment Secretary.
At the moment, we import 2/3 of all of our apples. We import 9/10 of all of our pears. We import 2/3 of our cheese. That is a disgrace.
In the 2016 EU referendum, she backed Remain, but has since become an outspoken advocate for Brexit.
I think at the time, and I did waver before making my decision about which side to back during the Brexit referendum, I didn't realise quite the catalyst Brexit would be in terms of shaping a new view of Britain. And I'm always somebody who wants things to move forward. I think we've got huge opportunities in this country and we need to make them real for people. And I now see Brexit as the catalyst that can help us achieve that. So becoming more competitive, becoming a lower tax economy, giving people in our country more opportunity, more freedom.
Under Theresa May, she became Justice Secretary, facing criticism for not standing up for the judiciary over tax and Brexiteers, labelling them enemies of the people. And she had some novel ideas for how to stop drones being used to smuggle drugs into prisons.
But what we are doing is solutions such as installing extra netting. I was at HMP Pentonville last week. They've now got patrol dogs who are barking, which helps deter drones.
Liz Truss then became Chief Secretary to the Treasury, and when Boris Johnson became Prime Minister, he made her International Trade Secretary, striking out around the world to secure trade deals and Instagram likes. It also allowed her to push her pro-trade, low-tax agenda.
Be positive and pro-enterprise, and that is the way we're going to grow the economy, which will mean we've got more money to spend on public services and cutting taxes, which I think is incredibly important. Britain is only going to succeed as a low-tax economy, and it's one of the main reasons for leaving the EU, is to give us that freedom and flexibility to do things differently. When people talk about austerity, most people across the country, as well as talking about public services, also mean their own personal, you know, what they're earning every month, what they're paying out every month. And it's really important that we keep taxes low and we make sure that people aren't paying too much over in taxes. Businesses too, because the more money businesses can keep, the more they can invest and the more they can grow the economy.
She's been an outspoken critic of government intervention, notably over things like the sugar tax designed to tackle obesity.
In general, I don't believe we should moralise through the tax system, and I think that we should have taxes that are efficient, as simple as possible.
In short, Liz Truss believes that the role of the government is to get out of the way.
I believe the government should be there, first of all, to make sure that we have a safe country where people can live free lives. And I also believe that children need to be given the capability, the decision-making, to be able to make decisions. But I believe when people are adults, they should be free to live the lives that they seek to lead. They should be free to decide and determine their own future. And we shouldn't have too much of the government telling them what to do, because I think that infantilises people. I think we now need to allow people to be able to make their own decisions. And I think that is a core part of being a Conservative.
The daughter of anti-nuclear campaigners, who then became a Lib Dem anti-monarchist and then a Conservative pro-Remainer, Liz Truss is reinventing herself again. Now Foreign Secretary, she's posing as the Margaret Thatcher of the internet age. But is that enough to get her to cross the threshold of number 10. We're talking about Liz Truss. Who is Liz Truss? She's supposedly one of the front runners to become Prime Minister, but in a poll by YouGov for this programme last week, we found 45% of people didn't even know who she was. Well, let's speak to Henry Zephyr, Chief Political Correspondent at The Times, to try and fill things in. Hi, Henry.
Hi, Matt. Good to be with you.
Give us a sense, first of all, of where the public are on Liz Truss. As I've mentioned, she's been in the Cabinet continuously for longer than anyone else, and yet almost half of people don't know who she is. What about amongst those Tory party members who might ultimately decide who would replace Boris Johnson?
Well, there was some really interesting polling by Opinion yesterday of Conservative Party members. You don't get sort of properly weighted polling of the party membership that often. And they found that she was the second favourite, if there were a contest, which those members didn't seem that keen on, by the way, but that she was the favourite choice of 33% of those party members. The problem for her is that Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, was the favourite choice of 44% of those party members. And if you put them in a runoff, which is, of course, how the leadership system works, Sunak would beat her by 28 points. Now, look, this is early days. Of course, in that scenario, there would be a campaign where she would hope that she would be able to win round some of those people who aren't backing her yet. But look, she's well placed. Of course she is. She's the Foreign Secretary. She's a very experienced politician. But it still seems pretty clear that Rishi Sunak is the front runner, in Boris Johnson's phrase, the ball to come loose from the scrum.
What about her politics? I mean, she's very big on sort of personal freedom, low tax and so on. But for someone to have served under successively David Cameron, Theresa May, and Boris Johnson, to have never resigned or found a, you know, had a policy row, does that mean she's very adept at politics? Does that mean that actually she's not quite as ideological as she makes out, and actually can go from Cameron to May to Johnson quite smoothly? How strongly held are her political views, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. You can't serve that long continuously in the cabinet without being a very deft and capable politician. I mean, you heard it in that montage, right? She was a pretty convinced Remainer, a very loyal part of the vast majority of the cabinet who campaigned behind David Cameron for Remain, but has come up with a formula in interviews that helps her explain her conversion. I mean, of course, the conversion is above all motivated by the fact that the UK voted to leave and the Conservative Party went in that direction. I mean, look, I don't think that's necessarily something to be sniffed at, right? I mean, a lot of politicians who also would have had leadership ambitions at various points fell foul of the change from Cameron to May to Johnson and from Remain to leave in a way that she managed not to. But of course, it does open the question about her political convictions to some degree. On the other hand, when you are the Environment Secretary, as she was in her first cabinet job, you don't get a lot of opportunities to set out a developed political philosophy. And if you do, people will think you're a bit uppity. But now that she is the Foreign Secretary and a major player in Westminster, she does have more chance to do that. And certainly her politics are, as is widely talked about, you know, this sort of libertarian-leaning, low-tax, in many ways more traditional conservatism with a big C than that espoused by Boris Johnson to a degree, Rishi Sunak. But she also remains fiercely loyal, 100% loyal, as she put it, to Boris Johnson. So it's quite an interesting mix.
Henry Zephyr, stay there. Let's bring in Kirsty Buchanan, who was a special advisor for Liz Truss when she was Justice Secretary. Morning, Kirsty.
Good morning.
Are you surprised that she's now seen as a front runner to replace Boris Johnson?
Well, those of us that have been knocking around in Westminster as long as you and I have, Matt, can remember that when she first joined and she was back in the Britannia Unchained gang of that 2010 intake, she was then widely tipped to be a future leader in the making. And then her career took a bit of a nosedive, I think, under Theresa May. And she owes her political renaissance to Boris Johnson, who sort of plucked her out of relative cabinet obscurity and made her the regional trade secretary and gave her this incredible platform to, you know, wrap herself in the Union Jack flag and rule Britannia right across the globe. And that's given her a sort of fresh lease of life. So Henry's 100% right. She is 100% loyal to Boris right now. She owes her newfound fortune to him. But also her allies don't think, you know, it would serve her well right now for a contest, because she needs to prove herself. And she's in some ways like the continuity Boris campaign candidate. So if he left in the height of a crisis rather than a sort of much smoother time, it would not serve her prospects very well. So I think for them, it plays better for her allies. It plays better for the contest to run long rather than sort of happen in the next few months.
It's interesting that she'd be the continuity Boris Johnson, because she's very outspoken. She likes a photo op, which, you know, I think it's fair to say that Boris Johnson's a fan of. Was that something that you were conscious of back when she was at Justice? I mean, she was always quite keen on posing with various things and, you know, her Instagram and so on. I mean, it's just been turned up to 11 since she's been at International Trade and then the Foreign Office. At the end of last year, there was a story about how there were more photos of her on the government's Flickr account than all of the rest of the cabinet put together. She's very conscious of how image matters in politics.
Oh, 100%. Look, image does matter in politics, and she's had more image changes than Madonna, I think, in her time in government, hasn't she? So if you look at the Instagram account, that's it. It charts this kind of ditzy, ingenue, quite young cabinet minister who makes lots of mistakes and is all sort of windswept and interesting on the beaches of Norfolk. And then it gets more corporate as she goes into sort of international trade. And there's lots of dull shots of her standing next to men in suits. And now we've got into this sort of stratospheric kind of global leader, low shot, striding across the stage with incredible backdrops behind her. And it sort of charts that kind of growing confidence that she has. But from someone that's like, you know, she's now got one of the highest offices in the state. And she, as you say, she's been in cabinet longer than any other serving minister. So she definitely sees herself as a contender. She knows that image matters. And yeah, she's prepared to exploit that.
Now, one of the things she's been doing is sort of modelling herself on Margaret Thatcher, even posing in a tank, just to really hammer that home for people who aren't paying attention at home. She's talked about going from chanting Margaret Thatcher, out with her parents on protest, but now sort of espousing late Thatcherite economics. Well, let's bring in Mark Littlewood. He's the head of the Institute for Economic Affairs, a free market think tank, which loves all this stuff. Morning, Mark. What's your assessment on Liz Truss? Is she really the heir to Thatcher?
I think in many ways she is. I think that, you know, the comparison is really only made because she's a woman. And it's very difficult for any woman politician in the Conservative Party to avoid some sort of comparison to Margaret Thatcher, whether flattering or not. It is sort of her agenda. I mean, you've highlighted, or if you were to highlight the low tax, sort of deregulate the economy, allow enterprise to boom sort of stuff, Matt. Yes, there's not much difference between Margaret Thatcher's approach and Liz Truss's on the bare bones of economic policy and strategy. But there are as many marked differences as well. Your package highlighted she's very socially liberal. She doesn't really mind what people get up to in their private lives, what lifestyle choices they make. That's quite a big difference between her and Mrs. T. I think she's also a difference that you might point out is that she has this sort of unbounded energetic optimism about her Liz Truss and that sort of a rising tide will raise all ships. Whereas I think Mrs. Thatcher was a bit more combative, saw sort of the fight for reforming Britain in the 1980s as a sort of form of class war. You are either with or against her. She sort of famously coined the phrase and kept asking, is she one of us? And so she very much saw it as people being on her side or against her. I think Liz Truss is a bit more collegiate than that, doesn't see it as class war. So there are some similarities. I think that your other contributors are right. She is on the low tax, low spend side of the Conservative Party, but also on the socially liberal side of the Conservative Party. And that's quite an interesting mix. And I would say the bookmakers have probably got it about right, Matt. Who am I to criticise market prices for being wrong? That she probably is the second favourite in the race, that probably if you had to call it now, although everybody is odds against, but you'd probably say Rishi Sunak is the favourite as we speak now. Of course, we don't know if there will be an election for leader, but Liz Truss probably is the second favourite. She's in with a sporting chance, in my view.
Is there an issue, Mark? You come on the show every other Monday and we talk about your take on economics, and you often remark that you feel like you're slightly shouting at a brick wall, your worldview, free market economics, let the market decide, low tax, low public spending, small state. That's not particularly where the public are right now. And I just wonder whether that's a good place. It might be a good place to tickle a particular constituency in the Conservative Party. Is that a good place, do you think, for Liz Truss to be in terms of public opinion?
I think it actually is, oddly enough, because I think that her pitch is going to be that she doesn't decide what to do by looking at the spot price in a focus group or what the present opinion polls say today. And you're right, if you look at opinion polls, people seem relatively content with sort of high public spending, and there hasn't been a public rebellion over tax. But I think, again, to make the Mrs. T comparison, she's more likely to say, well, look, these are the policies that I think will work. They may not even be popular at the time of implementation, but if they work, I have confidence that the results will be so spectacular that people will then flock to my banner. And that's very much how Margaret Thatcher operated. I can barely think of a Thatcherite policy that was popular at the time it was implemented, even the sale of council houses. But she was so convinced that the policies would work and would become popular down the line. And I would expect, were we to get Prime Minister Truss, that a similar strategy would be followed.
That's a really interesting point, actually, that actually having something that you genuinely believe is a good idea and then following it through. I mean, it's a novel approach to politics, but it's a particularly difficult one. What I want to do is come around all of you again and just ask, if Liz just picked up the phone to you and asked, what do I need to do? Some advice, you know, is there a weakness that she needs to address? Let's start with you, Henry Zeffman. We've heard that she's holding Fizz with Liz parties with MPs, Biz with Liz meetings with businesses and so on. What do you think Liz Truss needs to do to fulfil what is quite obviously her aim, albeit not one that's shifted the dial yet? Your advice for Liz Truss?
Yeah, I think she's in a pretty good position with MPs, actually. I'm particularly struck in conversations by how popular she is with the 2019 intake, who are, of course, incredibly numerous. I think they're about a third of the Conservative parliamentary party. I think Kirsty's absolutely right. I think the thing she needs to do is wait a little bit. I know that's not really in her gift, but I think a period showing that she is up to the job of foreign secretary, that she is a serious stateswoman, will be the best card in her favour. If she can say, look, I'm a successful foreign secretary, I've got good links on the global stage, and it's not too much of a stretch to go from there into Downing Street. I think that it will be the best thing in her favour, rather than trying to make the leap after what are just a few short months at this stage, holding that great office of state.
Henry Zeffman, Chief Minister, of course, one of the times. Thank you for that. Mark Littlewood, your advice for Liz Truss?
Yeah, I think it's interesting because although your other contributors and you, Matt, and your package pointed out that it is possible to detect Liz Truss's sort of philosophy and general approach to the world, I think that's true. She's quite transparent and outspoken on that. But I think she probably hasn't yet delivered a kind of barnstorming and deep and meaningful 40-minute speech from a platform. She's done lots of media interviews, lots of Instagram posts, has you know, written lots of newspaper articles. But I wonder whether at some point, without looking seditious, she needs to actually set out her vision in quite a high-profile speech, you know, possibly at Conservative conference, possibly somewhere else. And I'm scratching my brain to think whether she's done that. I think not. So although I think she's pretty good on the media, I think she knows her own mind, I think her sort of slight quirkiness on social media is a benefit. You might say that she hasn't yet set out in grandstanding terms what her vision for the country is. And if she could find an opportunity to do that without coming across as rebellious and without undermining the present administration, I think that's an opportunity she should seize.
Mark Littlewood from the Institute for Economic Affairs, thank you for that. Last word then to Kirsty Buchanan. You've been there, you worked with Liz Truss when she was in government. You later worked in Number 10 too, so you know what the job involves to be Prime Minister. Your advice to Liz Truss?
Yeah, I mean, I would play to your strengths always if you want to be a leader. And God love Liz, but her strengths are not in public oratory, are they, and in delivering speeches. They've got a lot better since the low point of the cheese speech, but it's still not her strength. Mine would be, look, play the long game, put your head down, be seen to be doing a serious job of being the foreign secretary. You can map out your vision in slow time, in op-eds, and she's beginning to shape a vision for where she sees Britain. Plug away at that, put your head down and get on with the job and let people see you doing a serious piece of work.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no,
so
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.